The headlines, President Rouhani describes as a great victory the top UN court's decision to rule on Iran's lawsuit against U.S. sanctions. A U.S. warship sails through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated objections from China in the first such voyage since the inauguration of President Joe Biden. And also in our headlines, the European Union rejects a U.K. demand to extend a grace period for checks on goods moving between Britain and Northern Ireland. Hello and welcome everybody here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Iran's president has hailed an interim ruling by the International Court of Justice that it will take on Iran's lawsuit against U.S. sanctions.
The Hague-based International Court of Justice had ruled in our favor and issued an interim order for the U.S. to lift all humanitarian-related sanctions. The U.S. did not abide by the ruling, and that was a violation. But for us, that was a great victory. Then the Americans claimed that the ICJ did not have jurisdiction over the matter. The top UN court has been discussing the Iranian lawsuit for months. Washington tried very hard to prove that the ICJ had no jurisdiction over the case. But Wednesday's court ruling that it will take on Iran's case is another great victory for us.
Hassan Rouhani said the U.S. tried very hard to quash the case, arguing the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. Earlier, U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price expressed disappointment, saying the top U.N. court did not accept, quote, well-founded legal arguments. On Wednesday, the ICJ unanimously refuted all the preliminary objections to its jurisdiction raised by the U.S. Tehran filed the lawsuit in mid-2018 after the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and reinstated sanctions. Tehran accused Washington of breaching the 1955 bilateral treaty of amity and ruining millions of lives. Political analyst Greg Simon says a decision by the International Court of Justice to review the case brought by Iran against the U.S. shows Washington's sanctions are illegal.
Well, I mean, it's a confirmation that the U.S. has not been, according to its own rhetoric of slogans and catchphrases, engaging in this humanitarian maximum pressure. And these things, what they have been doing is illegal. I mean, it's not about human rights and democracy. It's about the ability to try and subvert another country's government by imposing illegal sanctions on it. And now these sanctions have been declared as being illegal by the court. There'll be a lot of legal weasel words, as you'd call them, which will be coming out, and other little interpretations. They'll probably ignore it. I mean, they've had other international courts, such as the, there was some Caribbean country that took them to the WTO and won, and the US just simply ignored it.
A US warship has once again sailed through the Taiwan Strait, despite repeated objections from China and amid heightening tensions between Beijing and Washington. The U.S. Navy says the warship conducted a routine transit through the strategic waterway separating the Chinese mainland and Taiwan. This was the first such move since the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president. Beijing views any ships passing through the strait as essentially a breach of its sovereignty. Late last month, an aircraft carrier group led by USS Theodore Roosevelt also entered the South China Sea. That after Taiwan reported an incursion by Chinese warplanes into its air defense identification zone. Beijing is critical of Washington's boosting ties with the island, which it views as part of its territory. It has repeatedly called on the U.S. to abide by the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Well, we're now joined by author and columnist Daner Tangen, who's joining us from Beijing. Mr. Tangen, please give us your thoughts on what the situation is like right now between Washington and China. Were you expecting to see a reduction of tensions given the new administration at the White House?
Well, not really. I don't think it's going to be the same as with Donald Trump. But keep in mind, this is the first pass-through of U.S. ships. It comes on the eve of a major foreign policy speech by Joe Biden. I think within his cabinet, it's quite clear that there are those who believe that there are more pressing issues like climate change, health, peace, and trade. But there are also those that believe that the answers for that are, in essence, to create a grand coalition against China. So coming on the eve of his speech, I think this is an attempt to show that he's not giving any ground. Remember, there's a bipartisan anti-China feeling, not only among the American people, but also in Congress. So Joe Biden, although he has great designs and will eventually have to work with China on a lot of these major international issues, is trying to signal that he is not going to be a pushover, that he believes in the same aims as Donald Trump, but not the same strategy in order to get there.
And what about the issue of Taiwan right now? How big of a pawn is that in the relations between Washington and Beijing?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I mean, unfortunately, it looks like the Biden administration, despite having quite a bit of experience, is treating Taiwan like it's a playing card. Unfortunately, on the Chinese side, it's not a playing card, it's a red line. So these are the type of very dangerous situations which can, in fact, lead to an armed conflict. Miscalculations can be easily had. Now, hopefully, there are enough back-channel communications, and eventually they will take the military part of this off the table and keep it just to trade and politics, and hopefully keep those under control, because it's going to be necessary not only for these two economies, but also for the rest of the world to maintain some semblance of peace. There's enough discord in the world because of the pandemic, because of the health issues and the economic issues. Social unrest is going to continue to rise over the next few years. So unless these two countries come together and realize that they have a greater responsibility for promoting peace and getting the world back on track, you could see some real damage to the world as a whole.
All right, thanks a lot, author and columnist Daniel Tang, and joining us from Beijing. Well, the United Kingdom has condemned the detention of Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other top officials in a military coup. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab called for the immediate release of the detainees and the removal of all charges against them. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he will mobilize all the key factors in international community to put enough pressure on Myanmar's military junta to make sure the coup fails. He added that it's absolutely unacceptable to reverse the results of an election in Myanmar. On Monday, Myanmar's military declared 1 year of emergency and detained top officials. The coup and detentions came after days of escalating tensions between the government and the military. Military generals claimed the last parliamentary elections were fraudulent. The military action has been condemned globally. News review where we look into some of the top stories of the day. Stay tuned. On this news review, the European Union has rejected a UK demand to extend a grace period for checks on goods moving between Britain and Northern Ireland. European Commission Vice President Tomáš Šefčovič said a post-Brexit trade deal signed in December gives London enough tools to solve the problems. However, he said the bloc will work aggressively with Britain to resolve difficulties that have already impeded deliveries of goods. On Wednesday, British Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove asked that grace periods for the transportation of food to Northern Ireland be extended until 2023. The UK left the EU on January the 1st. Under the deal, Northern Ireland remains in the EU's single market, but checks are imposed on goods moving between there and Britain with a three-month grace period for food items. Professor of Economics at City University, Mr. Keith Pilbeam, is joining us on this edition of the News Review. He's with us from London. We also have David Hearn, Research and Economist, and rather economist at the Center for Brexit Studies, joining us from Birmingham. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Pilgrim. What are we looking at right now with the extension of a grace period on checks and goods? What does it mean, and is it plausible?
Well, let's be clear. The British signed a document. They signed an agreement. They got a little bit of extension for the food for 3 months. But after that, that's it. You've signed an agreement. Now, you can't go blaming the EU to something you've actually just recently signed an agreement to. Look, this lies fairly and squarely with the British government, the incompetence. They had to do everything at the last minute in the negotiations. Things have not been thought through properly. What it means on the ground, okay? And what it means on the ground is chaos. And especially it creates this border between Northern Ireland and the UK. This government decided to leave the customs union. All right, now the second you leave the customs union, you've created the Irish question. All right, and then to ask the EU to solve the problem is ridiculous. All right, because it's this government that decided to leave the customs union. We could have avoided all the paperwork. We could have avoided the border control by remaining within the customs union. All right, we could even offer to keep similar tariffs against the rest of the world as the EU. And that might, the EU might sort of let us in, although that needs ratification by the WTO. So the British government has signed a document and is now, within weeks, as it unravels, trying to find a way out. But they've agreed to this. The chaos that's going on in Britain is not just confined to Northern Ireland, it's confined to Calais, Dover, it's confined to all sorts of businesses up and down the country. It's not hitting the headlines because the headlines are all about COVID. In normal circumstances, any government would be called to account for this. But, you know, people are stuck at home. They're not realising the impact of all this. And the impact is devastating.
David Hearn, do you agree with that? People probably not realising the impact, or how devastating the impact has been so far.
I suggest that there's a differential impact depending on where you are. I mean, certainly I've seen anecdotal evidence, and I've seen news evidence, and I think there is strong evidence in favour of saying that there have been definite difficulties, and that's in Great Britain, not Northern Ireland. There have certainly been issues as regards importing and exporting. There are certainly significant extra costs that have emerged as a result of the UK leaving the single market and customs union. In Northern Ireland, the issues are considerably more severe, and I think that needs to be stressed. There are issues around supplying supermarkets. There are issues as regards, you know, sort of empty shelves in Northern Ireland. So the issues emerging there are much more severe than those on the island of Great Britain. As regards the protocol and how that's enforced moving forward and how that works, that I think the important thing here to recognise is we are actually only barely a month into the operation of this. So we have to give some degree of time, and we have to work quite aggressively to scale up all of our ability to engage in proper customs checks and our ability to actually use all of the flexibilities that are on offer.
Mr. Pilgrim, just a moment ago you mentioned the Irish question. Is the situation right now with Northern Ireland far more convoluted than what was expected and what was written down on paper in the Brexit deal in the final draft of the negotiations?
Well, in theory, you know, Northern Ireland was supposed to have the best of both worlds. That's what the government said. They said that, you know, they could stay in the single market, be subject to EU rules, all right? And, you know, they would also, quote, listen carefully, have easy free trade and access to the GB with no barriers to trade. All right? Now, Boris Johnson dare not go to Northern Ireland at the moment, I suspect, because it was an outright lie. You see, there's no way of beating about the bush here. The British government has lied on a persistent basis about the implications of Brexit. He was even in Parliament saying there are no non-tariff barriers to trade. Outright lies. And they've got to be called for that, what they are. They're outright lies. And on the ground, there's no way, you know, you've got the protocol. The protocol's not going to disappear. So the question is about the management, the implementation. As I say, this government's so incompetent, they left the deal to the last minute. They don't have the right officials to deal with all this. People haven't experienced this kind of paperwork. They're not living in the real world. If real businesses are being inundated with folders of paperwork, health checks, how much notice did they have? Virtually no notice whatsoever over the Christmas period. It's a joke. There's no other word for it. It's complete chaos. And the blame lies squarely with this government that took so long to get a deal, that tried over the last minute arguing over a few fish. You know, a few fish. Put 0.1% of the British economy. And they didn't think about the chaos they would create for the rest of the economy. So there's no excuses. The blame lays clearly with the British government. The EU has negotiated a protocol. I think they were more than generous with that protocol, to be honest. They tried to get an Irish solution. And we've got to learn to live with it. The paperwork's not going to disappear. Things hopefully will improve. But you need goodwill. In order to get the EU to make some concessions, they need goodwill. The goodwill doesn't really exist.
David Hearn, Mr. Pilgrim, our guest in London, believes that chaos is unraveling in a more general sense. Were you in favor of Brexit, or do you think that it was a mistake?
On a personal level, I voted to remain part of the European Union. I think that as regards the operation of Brexit, I think we need to be kind of clear about this. There were always several options when the UK voted to leave the European Union, and the type of Brexit that we have left with was never preordained. So there's a question there in terms of what decisions has the UK made, what decisions have been made on the UK's behalf by the government, and were they the right ones? The UK government opted for what we might call a hard Brexit. Is that necessarily in the best interests of the population, and is that necessarily what the population voted for? Certainly there were a large portion of voters who did want that. Certainly if you speak to many who voted Leave, the desire was to move away completely and utterly from the EU's rulebook. Now, that hasn't happened completely. There are a number of restrictions on the kinds of changes that can be implemented by the UK, but the UK is to a significant extent outside of the kind of EU orbit. Now, in a number of sectors, I think what will happen is the UK will maintain regulations that look very similar to their EU counterparts, but that's an aside. So in terms of more general chaos, yes, there is some. I think it's affecting certain types of businesses, certain sectors much more intensely than others. It is really affecting agricultural exporters. For the more general economy, the levels of sort of difficulty for large businesses are much smaller. For smaller firms, you do see a lot of issues around paperwork and the additional costs of trade.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That was researcher and economist at Center for Brexit Studies, Mr. David Hearn, joining us from Birmingham. Also thanks to Professor of Economics at City University, Keith Pilbeam, speaking to us from the British capital. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
وسعت نام خورشید جلوه خاک تو قرمز و سبز و سپید نمنم من نمن منم من ذره خاک وطنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ایران خاک دلیران ایران کنام شیران ایران همیشه جاویدان.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Steve James. And joining me in the studio, we have Matthew Turner, who's a freelance film critic who writes for Vodzilla, iNews, and The List, among various other publications. And sitting next to him, we are also joined by political economist Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, this documentary centres on the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a small American Chinese-owned family bank situated in Manhattan's Chinatown in New York City, which, because it was deemed small enough to jail rather than too big to fail, became the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the mortgage crisis in 2008. And born in Shanghai, Thomas Tsung founded Abacus Federal in 1984, hoping to make it easier for Chinese immigrants to get loans. And the bank eventually became a community hub, but in 2012, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office charged it with mortgage fraud, also indicting 19 of its former employees. And this film shows the Tsung family fighting back against the charges and the toll it takes on them, as well as the Chinese community.
Today, we are announcing the indictment of the Federal Savings Bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy. A federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
If you are going to pick on a bank, family-owned company, wedged between a couple of noodle shops in Chinatown, is about as easy a target as you could possibly pick.
When I was a lawyer, there was no bank owned by Chinese and serving the Chinese. When I walk around here, I feel very much at home. This is a very tasty noodle shop.
That's always special. That's the butt.
When we were children, my dad was excited about this bank he was going to start.
We serve people who've never even dealt with the banking system before.
This whole ordeal began in 2009.
One of our loan officers stole money.
He was lying all over the place.
He was running a money laundering operation. I fired him that day.
They went straight to their regulator, and they told them about it.
The DA's office started asking us questions.
Wait a minute, maybe we're the target.
If that prosecution goes through, that bank is going to go out of business.
Although this is David versus Goliath, they're a whole family of lawyers.
We spent a lot of time investigating and ended up absolutely convinced that the loan department was corrupt through and through.
They routinely falsified mortgage documents.
Reporters in this town were treated to this extraordinary photo opportunity. This almost Stalinist-looking chain gang.
Herded like cattle down the hallway. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I've never seen that happen.
Mommy's worried. Papa's 80 years old, and he's been up since 5:30 a.m. He has nothing to eat for dinner. Let's get you some food. Papa, you do.
This is how he is. He's very calm, and I'm like a jumping bean, so I'm always running around.
You're going to eat now. You're going to lash, okay?
Abacus Federal Savings Bank had one of the nation's lowest default rates, not the highest, one of the lowest. Frankly, if every bank had underwritten as well as Abacus, we wouldn't have had a financial crisis.
People get the wrong impression that Chinese are not law-abiding.
This case is an attack on our community. We're easy prey.
Too big to fail turns into small enough to jail, and Abacus is small enough to jail.
Well, very well and welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary, I think, gives a refreshing look at the banking crisis in that, unlike many documentaries and films in this subject, we get to see the more personal stories and the social impact the crash had. Now, Matthew, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Abacus Small Enough to Jail?
Well, one of the most interesting things about it is we're used to seeing the big guy versus little guy stories, but the big guy is usually the bank. In this case, the little guy is the bank, and that sort of perspective, that sort of family-oriented perspective of it is very interesting. I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was a strong story, like you care deeply about the family, you get to know them very well. The director, as you said, he made Hoop Dreams, and he made the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself, and he's very good at those sort of small, intimate family stories. And it's a very effective story, very well told. The court case stuff is interesting, if not perhaps quite as dramatic as you're maybe expecting. I mean, I don't think the outcome of the film is particularly in doubt, but it's still a very enjoyable, piece to watch.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, what was your take on the film? Would you agree with what Matthew said?
Yeah, I think it was a very good film as a story of itself. And I think they gave enough suggestion of this too big to fail versus small enough to jail. But to actually do that whole story justice is really two films, and maybe something like The Big Short and this together actually show you more of the picture.
And what did you make of Matthew's point that this dynamic between sort of the big guy, not being the bank in this case, but the small guy?
Well, arguably the banks control the regulatory system anyway, so it's not really surprising. And our analysis would suggest that this was a targeted attempt to show that they were doing something about the crisis whilst quite willfully ignoring egregious crimes on a much larger scale.
And Matthew, as you were saying, you said that Steve James is good at telling personal family stories. In this documentary, though, it's quite politically charged. Do you think he was making a political statement?
I certainly think he was trying to. I mean, you have the press conferences and that Cyrus Vance, the DA, gives, where he's very sort of explicitly targeting the banks, whereas actually the reality is it's a very small bank and nothing really related to what you call Wall Street. And you have the quite extraordinary the scene we just saw in the clip there with the chain gang, which is just really shocking anyway. And everybody interviewed in the film says that they've been working in this business 25 years or more and they've never seen anything like that. And the implication is they would never have done that to white bankers, black bankers, anything like that.
Exonerating our entire community, no matter what we do, be it the little guy selling vegetables or a bank that's doing business. I told Mr. Song, I'm glad they pick on you, because you're a fighter.
Cyrus Vance just felt this is easier to attack, especially as a family bank. But he doesn't realize Tom is not easy to be pushed around. And my girls, they're tough, smart, capable women, so courageous.
Although this is David versus Goliath, David being Abacus Federal Savings Bank has a slingshot. And that is, their whole family of lawyers.
I was going to be able to fight this.
They're almost gleeful. They're like, we're going to have our day in court now. We're actually going to be able to show that they were wrong.
They made a decision that they were not going to plead guilty to something that they didn't feel the bank was guilty of. That is a courageous choice, and it's an expensive choice. The DA's office has hundreds of lawyers and took 5 years to do their grand jury investigations, and it is a daunting task to fight the government.
You could feel the enormous weight on their shoulders and the sort of stacks that are against them. Matthew, what did you make of their efforts of the Sung family to fight back?
Well, the filmmaker Steve James picks up the... I guess he's come on board the story somewhere after the court case begins and but before the result of the trial. So the cameras are actually there when the verdicts come in you get a lot of the... You're not obviously allowed cameras inside the courtroom, but there's a lot of court reconstruction, so you have a feel for how the toll that the trial itself is taking on them. And yeah, I mean, as that clip showed, they're very sort of feisty characters, and they're all three of the women are lawyers, and they're really, yeah, they're very hungry for the fight, if you like. You don't really get a sense of how the investigation is going from the other side. You only see them and their efforts to sort of fight back, and what they're doing as a family. You don't really get a sense of the DA's office. There are a couple of interviews with people who are involved in the DA's office, but they don't really tell you anything of great interest.
And Clive, would you agree? What did you make of the Sung's family's challenges and their struggle to fight back against the DA? Do you think they were justified?
They were certainly justified. I suspect the DA were quite surprised at the strength of their fight back, because I think the Chinese community, or Chinese as a culture, are generally quite diffident and respectful of authority. And I think they hoped to actually bring them, ship them into pleading guilty, and they failed.
I mean, absolutely, there is a clip where Tom Sung, basically, he's offered a plea deal, and then he says, no, I'm not going to take that plea deal. And it's really obvious that the DA's department thought they would just take that plea deal and, you know, all their problems would just magically go away. But no, that's, they
see this right all the way
to
the end.
They don't take the deal, exactly. And, I mean, as we say, it cost them $10 million. So another smaller business maybe wouldn't have been able to fight that the way they did.
And Clive, why was it then that, as the film claims, that Abacus was the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the 2008 financial crisis? You know, why don't we hear about major firms like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, or Countrywide being held to account?
Could you imagine the outrage if you had Jewish bankers chained like they chained those employees? There's a very simple reason. The fraud that they're talking about in this film is nothing to do with the subprime crisis in terms of what crimes were actually committed, because the loan default rate on the Fannie Mae loans, the injured party was supposedly Fannie Mae, who made a lot of money out of this bank's loan book. And there were 9 defaults out of 3,000 mortgages. And actually, as it says in the film, their loan history was infinitely better than anyone else. What was happening in the subprime crisis is what people were packaging up garbage and selling it. There are stories of senior managers in Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agencies, being shouted at, being told to rate stuff, even though they didn't have the files on which to rate it. So there was this huge fraud, this creation of an illusion of some sort of quality in a mortgage book that was full of holes, unlike Abacus Bank, which had really well-documented loans. Yes,
they had a case of a bad apple, but they fired the man who was giving out
there is
bad
obviously
loans.
A cultural element to this case, which is debt is a social construct in a community. If I'm related to you and I lend you money, whether you pay me back is much less important than if I've signed a piece of paper with someone. And that is a culture of this community. And you could argue that there was fraudulent documentation, but it wasn't obscuring what was actually going on in the way it was going on in the subprime crisis, where people who were never going to be able to pay it, they didn't have cash earnings on the side that they weren't declaring. They were never going to be able to repay these loans. And the people selling those mortgages knew that, and they bet against their clients at the same time. So the criminality of the system, which controls most of the regulation as well, is actually trying to use this little bank as some sort of flag waving that we're jailing bankers. The only country to jail bankers was Iceland, and they jailed 28. Every other country capitulated. And this case had nothing to do with the subprime crisis.
Former prosecutor, I'm not soft on crime. I've never seen a spectacle like this. These people were humiliated intentionally for no good reason.
It is not the district attorney's office's decision whether or not to put people in handcuffs, but people who were brought into court who have been charged with crimes are put into handcuffs. That's a decision that's made by the court officers. I won't go into it more than that because, you know, it's not something I'm involved with.
So in the film, we learn that the Abacus Bank plays an important role in the Chinese community. And we also find that it provides mortgages to immigrants who live sort of in a cash economy and have hidden assets. And we also learn more about Thomas Sung and his character in this film and his intentions, his noble intentions in starting the bank, as he believes that Chinese immigrants were being left out of the American dream. And what did you make of his character and his story?
Well, and the film explicitly uses clips from Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. The opening shot of the movie is Thomas Sung and his wife watching it and identifying very strongly with James Stewart's character, George Bailey, and particularly his position within the sort of small-town community, what feels like a small-town community, and helping people with small businesses, and he knows all the businesses, everybody knows who he is, and stuff like that. So there is very much that sort of man of the people element to Thomas Sung's story, I think.
And there's a scene in the documentary where we see that he's able to calm the crowds of all the clients who are rushing to get their money back, and he's able to soothe them.
Exactly like happens in It's a Wonderful Life. And in fact, the film shows clips of that exact same scene happening. It shows clips of George Bailey speaking to the crowd, preventing the run on the bank by telling them that your money's in his business and your money's in his business, and everybody's kind of helping each other. And you don't actually see Sung calming his own crowd, but he tells you have him telling the audience what he actually did, which is basically exactly the same thing. He went out and told everyone, calm down, trust me, you know me, I'm here, your money's safe, and it worked.
It was an uncanny moment. Scene, actually, yes, yeah. Absolutely. And Clive, the film shows and suggests that there were racial implications behind the charges. Why were they being singled out? Was it because they were Chinese?
I don't think it was racist in the sense that the Chinese are dishonest. I think it was the Chinese were seen as a soft touch. As Matthew said, they were visibly shocked when they wouldn't cave and cop a plea for guilty. Mm-hmm. They preferred to fight. And I think that was their undoing. Other than that, I don't think it was racist as such as demonizing a community, but clearly it had that effect. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, Matthew talked about It's a Wonderful Life, and banking is an inherently dishonest business, which I won't go into. But what has been banking's salvation over the years is the relationships, and that's what banking always used to be based on. But that has completely gone with these mega banks, so there is no relationship. So you are dependent on the forms, whereas in a bank like Abacus, you're dependent on the relationships, and that's what their business is. And that's in stark contrast to what was going on elsewhere and being ignored.
That's a really interesting point. Did you want to add anything to that, Matthew?
There was, on the racism element, there is a very telling comment from, I think it's the DA, and correct me if I'm wrong, but where he says, oh, well, no, of course we weren't racist. We didn't treat them any differently to the way we treat South American bankers or, Russian bankers or, he sort of lists another,
other ethnic groups,
yeah, but leaves one kind of fairly major group out, white bankers. And that's the kind of fairness you'd at least expect.
I never thought my girls would work in Chinatown because we lived in Greenwich, Connecticut. Tom would be commuting every day, like an hour and a half each way. So he didn't see them that much in those days. They had no idea anything, not a faintest idea about the Chinese community. In fact, Heather still doesn't. She hates the city, She's like me. We both have headaches. And at home, when we don't want them to understand, we speak Chinese.
You always said to me, if you come work for the bank, the benefit will be you have a 9-to-4 job.
9-to-4?
Yeah, because a long time ago, people could leave at 3 for the bank. He said, you can have children, you can have a family.
You know what he said to me? He said, if you wish to work with me, remember, this is your own choice. And don't think it's going to be easy. You gave me two different stories.
They're very endearing, warm family, and it makes you wonder. I wonder if any other bank CEOs are this caring. And Matthew, I just wanted to ask for your brief views on the family themselves and how they're portrayed.
I think they're great. I mean, they're very entertaining dynamic between certainly the daughters and the mother. The mother's the real star of the movie, in my opinion. And she sort of undercuts all of them with quite sort of funny comments. There's a whole sequence, a whole bizarre sequence where they're all sort of stressing about the sandwich that the father is eating and whether it's too dry and is he enjoying it and is he sure he's enjoying it and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, you've got to.
But then it just highlights the unfairness of the situation, that there's an old man enduring this ordeal.
Yeah, he's 80. He's 75 when the prosecution begins and he's 80 when it finishes. Although I have to say, he looks pretty damn good for 80.
Yeah, not bad at all. And Clive, I'd like to talk about the wider issues now of the film. Why isn't there, I get the sense of this theme in the film, that there's a lack of accountability in the banking world. What do you make of this?
If you look at the personalities and the structures, they're all related. So the banks, in effect, control the central banks, they control the regulators, and so what appears to be wrongdoing can always be covered up. So you take the example of HSBC money laundering. They confessed. So the Department of Justice had a cast iron case. They were lent on by a combination of George Osborne, Adair Turner, and Mark Carney, Chancellor of the Bank of England, head of the FSA at the time, and Chancellor of the Exchequer. They all sit on the Bank of International Settlements Board. So there is this web of power that sits over the financial system that actually ensures its own survival. That's why they bullied Congress into bailing out the banks in 2008, because they control the
levers
of power.
And we saw this in our country as well. Why is there such a tight relationship between the banks and the government? Aren't the banks supposed to serve the people?
Well, it comes back to that Rothschild quote, that let me control a nation's money supply and I care not about its laws. Simply money gives you control, particularly when you can create that money from nothing. So you can buy politicians, you can bribe politicians, you can pay people to kill politicians. So what's a politician got to do? He's got to obey orders.
There's some very hot issues you raise. But does this film evoke these sort of wider questions and raise issues about the morality of banking? Did you get that sense also from watching this documentary?
In this particular story, it's more focused on this small family and their small bank, and how, as Clive said, that this what happens to the Sung family is not related to the wider financial crisis. It's not the same, you know, the same thing. So in that sense, no, but you are very much aware of the financial crisis in the background, and certainly, like I said, the press conference that D.A. Cyrus Vance gives, where he gives this very sort of ebullient statement about, well, yes, we're going to be jailing these bank effect, well, words to the effect of, we're going to be jailing these bankers, without really going into the detail. Yeah, certainly that's there.
Well, certainly we learn that they emerge victoriously from this, the Sung family.
That's a spoiler, but yes.
Yes, a little spoiler, but I think it's public knowledge sort of now that this court case has gone on. But just final thoughts now. Matthew, what's your verdict on this film and would you recommend it?
I would certainly recommend it. It's a very entertaining story. But, yeah, it makes you angry a little bit, and it's, you know, it's always interesting to see film documentaries where there's a strong sense of injustice, and particularly if it ends well, then that's, you know, all for the better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it certainly.
And final thoughts to you also, Clive. Would you recommend this documentary?
I certainly would. What spoke volumes to me is that Ken Yu, the DA star witness, was the original fraudster that was reported by the bank to the authorities, and they revoked his plea bargain at the end and charged him. And so, you know, that tells you exactly what was going on.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but just quickly.
I just wanted to add to that, actually, that really stuck out for me as well. Like, not only that, the original fraudster becomes the prosecution's star witness, which is just insane. I really couldn't understand that at all, like how that was allowed to happen. Basically, somebody who has confessed to lying and been caught lying and committing fraud becomes the star witness. Like,
it's a very puzzling business indeed, but I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, and we'll come to the end of this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام في قوله تعالى ولسوف يعطيك ربك فترضى الشفاعة والله الشفاعة والله الشفاعة.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated with regards to Allah's verse in the Holy Quran, soon your Lord will give you that which you will be pleased, in the Holy Quran, Surah 93, Ayah 5. This is intercession. By Allah, it is intercession. By Allah, it is intercession.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. When sifting through the various historical texts of Islam, looking for interesting and golden conversations between the infallibles, their students, or their companions, or their fellow men, we've run across one very special conversation, a truly golden dialogue between a very famous companion and a very knowledgeable student by the name of Jabir al-Jufi and the fifth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is said to have been one of the Imams who was able to put forth the most amount of traditions, and in reality it is said that it was Imam al-Baqir who founded the university in Medina, which was grown by Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. And so we find that in this exchange of knowledge, many conversations took place. One such conversation, again, was between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. In this conversation, high moral standards are put forth. And in one of these conversations, we find the following statement from Imam al-Baqir. He says, "There is no justice like equity, fairness, impartiality, and there is no aggression like injustice." It is interesting, dear friends, but in this world and in this era which we live in, justice has a very strange definition and aggression has a very strange definition. We don't think that injustice is a big deal, and we don't think that justice is a big deal either. But in reality here, Imam al-Baqir tells all of us in this conversation with Jabir al-Jufi that the greatest kind of justice is to be impartial, to be fair, to be equitable. And truly it is difficult to be impartial, but if we are impartial, then truly we have been just. And on the other hand, he says that the greatest aggression, the greatest oppression, the greatest subjugation is injustice. So in our lives, dear friends, we must try to stay away from injustice and try our very best to live a life of justice. Beautiful words exchanged in this golden conversation between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
In another narration, he says, "Kana al-Imam alayhi salam kathir al-buka fi akthar al-awqat khawfan min Allah." Kana kathir al-buka. He used to cry a lot. Why? He fears Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Kana akthar an-nasi tawadhu'an. He was so humble. And humility is the characteristic of a real person. No one can imitate humility except for a few moments, and then he will forget. People of humility, this characteristic of humility is their gift. And they earn it because they practice it for quite a long time. He kana akthar an-nasi tawadhu'an. Kana askha an-nas. He was so generous, kind. Imam alayhi salam kana yatasaddaqu fi kulli jum'ah. Not only in a normal days, but Fridays, it was a special day for him, like today. He used to give sadaqah every Friday. And he used to say, inna sadaqata yawm al-jum'ah tatadha'af. If you give charity on Friday, it will be manifold, it will increase. Now, when we look at the mawa'idh of Imam salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi, we come to learn, Imam alayhi salam has said, thalathatun min makarimid dunya wal akhira, an ta'fuwa amman zalamak, wa taswila man qata'ak, wa tahluma idha juhila alayk. Three things are the peak of akhlaq in this dunya and the akhirah. Makarim dunya. These are the best akhlaq in this world as well as in the hereafter. He says, number one, forgive the one who wrongs you. It's not easy. Someone wrongs you, you know, you keep it to yourself. You carry it throughout your life. Wherever you see him, you are burn with rage. Yeah, you want to do something bad. But Imam alayhi salam says, no, if you want to be among the people of akhlaq of this world and next, remember to forgive. When you forgive and you don't forget, it will still haunt you. Imam alayhi salam says, an ta'fuwa amman dhalamak. Forgive the one who has wronged you. When you forgive, forget. Because if you don't forget, then it will still come back to you.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.